Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg on a Tuesday.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. In a little bit,
yes.
Hold on, we are going to talk with Catherine Price, the author of a book called How to Break Up with Your Phone. Gosh, I wish I could. The book is all about cell phone addiction and how our attachment to this form of technology changes our connections with other people.
It absolutely does. And have you ever been at a restaurant and your friend could not get off their phone? Or have you ever been curious about the do's and don'ts when it comes to cell phones? Or are you that person who just cannot put your phone down? Well, call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
And I just want to acknowledge the mixed messages of having people call us for this particular show. But again, the number is 888-477-9499. And then later in the hour, we have newly minted Fresh Air co-host Tanya Mosley in studio. Really looking forward to that conversation.
And it's very exciting. But first, let's dig into our top news stories today. Avi, you're up first.
I like this tidbit. This is there's a new report by the Center for Rural Pennsylvania that looks at demographics in the rural parts of the state. No surprise. I don't think people will be shocked to learn that there are more, the death rate in rural PA outpaces the birth rate. This that's an aging population in rural Pennsylvania and has been so for some time. But what I found most interesting is that net migration is positive, or at least it was in 2019 and 2021, which means more people chose to move to rural Pennsylvania than move out of rural Pennsylvania. So you get rid of the deaths and the births, and there's actually a positive net migration in rural Pennsylvania. Specifically, a lot of it concentrated in the northeastern part of the state. So I just found that fascinating. This is not a report that gets into why, but it's just something that made me think.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I will mention that Pennsylvania has one of the lowest birth rates in the country, and rural Pennsylvania's rate is below the state average.
Right, so it's very low.
Yeah, so it's very low. And I should also mention that nationally, the birth rate is up about 0.9 of a percentage point from 2021 to 2022, probably all those pandemic babies.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was interesting about this report as well is that they noted a lot of the people moving to rural areas were coming from urban areas. And I mentioned that a lot of that net migration was in the northeastern part of the state. Mm-hmm. And if you can look at a map of Pennsylvania in your head, that's the part that's kind of close to New York City.
Yeah.
And so it's just an interesting trend. And it would be interesting to dig a little more into who those people are, why they're picking rural areas, and, you know, how much that will impact the future of those rural areas, even as they deal with this imbalance between births and deaths.
Yeah.
Just something to think about.
Yeah. We need the babies. Everybody loves the babies, right? Moving on to New Jersey, the sign Feld bill was signed into law on Monday. Now, this new legislation requires that telemarketers give key information within 30 seconds of calling someone. This bill is nicknamed the Seinfeld bill after an iconic moment on that show. Take a listen.
All right, go ahead, Susan. Tell him.
Tell me what?
Well,
I'm sorry. Excuse me one second. Hello? Oh, gee, I can't talk right now. Why don't you give me your home number and I'll call you later?
I'm sorry. We're not allowed to do that.
Oh, I guess you don't want people calling you at home.
No.
Well, now you know how I feel.
Studio applause.
Oh. Yeah. But who likes to be called at home? And now, who likes to be called on their cell phone by random people? Yeah. So under this new law, Ivy, telemarketers, they must identify themselves, who they are representing, and what they are selling within the first 30 seconds of the call. And they have to provide a phone number to reach their employer.
Two things I liked about the story. Uh-huh. One is that it was championed by a Republican state senator who moonlights as a comedian. So there's a tie there. I also, it makes me think about the fact that even in public service and government, branding is very important. Mm-hmm. So someone had the bright idea to call this the Seinfeld bill, which got us talking about it, which I'm sure is going to make people more aware of it. So branding is not just something that exists in private enterprise. Yes, it exists in government too. And if you want people to pay attention to your accomplishments, it often helps to have a snappy little name.
It does. And by the way, this bill had bipartisan support, and telemarketers, they get no love in Jersey. Okay, mm-hmm. Because it's illegal to call people on the do not call list. And already there was a law where people had to identify themselves, who they were and why they were calling within the first half minute. So New Jersey does not play.
Can I just add, though? But at least for me, the telemarketing thing is annoying, but it doesn't feel like as big a problem as it used to, because your cell phone just identifies the number often as spam or as like a weird number that you've never seen before. I never pick up those calls.
But you know what? If I get another call about a warranty on my car.
You pick those up?
I get caught sometimes.
You get caught sometimes.
What can I say?
I feel like my screening process is pretty Loctite. Airtight, excuse me.
Speaking of someone who got caught.
Yeah, gosh. Yeah. So this is a story about a fellow media organization mm-hmm. in our region. So during newsrooms, probably their busiest night of the year, the Philadelphia Inquirer will not have any journalists in the building because of a cyber attack that happened over the weekend. They were unable to print the Sunday newspaper. They called it the greatest disruption to their flow, to their process since 1996. That's when we had a huge blizzard here in Philadelphia. And the FBI is involved in the investigation. Looks like reporters are going to be able to work around this today. And we should shout out, even though they are a competitor of ours, they do fantastic election reporting coverage and they do a great job keeping people informed. And we hope that this does not, you know, break up their flow too
and
much.
And I will say shout out to all the reporters who did workarounds to get the digital edition of the Sunday paper up despite the hack. And my old employer got hacked. And let me tell you, being a communications company where you don't have access to your communication, like we were locked out of our email for a couple of weeks, it is very difficult and you don't know what to do. Yeah. And it comes all of a sudden and you still have to do your job. So there you go.
Speaking, I guess, of locked out, the former Philadelphia 76ers head coach is now going to be, I guess, locked out of the Camden training facility that the Sixers use because we just got the notice, I think just before the show started, that the Sixers have fired their head coach of the last three seasons, Doc Rivers. And I don't know, what's the summary of his time here? He was here for three seasons. They made it to the same stage of the playoffs 3 years in a row, but never were able to get any further. And so it looks like they're going in a new direction. So we just got a notice about that. We'll pass that along.
Yeah.
However you all want to feel about that.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's always the question, do you fire the team or do you fire the coach? And in this case, Doc Rivers lost out.
Can I tell you something, though?
Yes.
A little story. 3 years ago, when he first became the coach, of course, everyone loved him. He was the new coach. He was going to, you know, take the franchise to the next level. And he was the featured speaker at a huge Joe Biden rally down in South Philly that I covered. Huge applause for him. It was pouring rain. People didn't care.
And now they're giving them the boot.
3 years is a short time for us. It's a long time in the world of a head coach in a major sports league. Boy, the fortunes change fast. Feel a little bad for
them. Yeah, they didn't even wait, though. They were like, they were still stinging from that loss on Sunday.
It doesn't take long.
And, you know, getting back to the polls, because this is election day. I mean, the polls are open. We've seen mayoral candidates. They casted their ballots this morning.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Helen Gim was the first to cast her ballot right at 7 a.m. at the Moore College of Art and Design. And then Sherelle Parker voted in West Oak Lane with her son. And then Alan Dom, Jeff Brown, and Rebecca Reinhardt, they all voted at the same location, the 10th Presbyterian Church near Rittenhouse Square. I was thinking about that. I was like, yo, how do three candidates live in the same vicinity such that they vote at the same precinct?
Because people who live in Philly might not understand, but like the geographic area that encompasses like one voting location is usually pretty small. Like they have to be pretty close neighbors to all be voting at the same location. And I believe they all voted like around the same time. Like Dom went in and came out, then Brown came in and then came out, and then Rebecca Reinhardt came in and came out. Like they were like passing each other as they were voting, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, it's like, but this is a, you know, sort of like a tradition. You know, you take the pictures of people voting on the first day, but on election day, but it was just interesting. I'm like, they're all from the same district.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
It's interesting.
It's interesting, to say the least.
Of course, today is the day to vote, if you didn't know that already. Primary day here in Pennsylvania. And if you're out at the polls, Sherry, you might see one of our own reporters, because we've got reporters all over the city and the region today.
That is absolutely right. WHYY will have continuing coverage of the races in the city and suburbs all the way until midnight tonight, and we'll go live to the headquarters of the top candidates for mayor. But WHYY's Sam Searles is already out there. She's at Lamberton Little Schoolhouse in Overbrook. That's the far end of West Philly, and she's on the line right now. Sam, welcome to Studio 2.
Hey, how are you?
We're doing great.
Yeah.
How are you? Talking to some voters this morning? What are you hearing?
A couple of voters so far have said hi, but have been a little shy, but that's okay. I have actually been talking to a bunch of poll workers, though. There's a lot out here that are very excited about this election, say that it's really important and that they're excited to be here.
Yeah, and what has been the turnout? Because have you talked to those poll workers? What are the numbers of folks that have shown up already from sure. at the polls you've been to?
Well, I've talked to a couple people here so far. There's a few different divisions reporting. I'm getting a couple different things. I'm going to pull up my notes over here so I don't tell you the wrong numbers. Ruth is a poll worker here. She's telling me that she's counting for Ward 34, Division 27. She's got 48 votes as of about 5 minutes ago. That's out of 561 Ooh. Eligible voters so far. But she says that mornings are usually very, very quiet here, and that was true for the other poll workers that I talked to as well.
I wanted to ask you, Sam, about some of the coverage you've been doing leading up to this, because you're a gun violence prevention reporter. That was mm-hmm. a huge, huge part of this campaign. It seemed every candidate said public safety was the number one issue. Did you get a sense right. in your coverage that voters felt the same way? And do you get a sense of what voters want to see?
Absolutely. I mean, there's been a ton of work that myself and Sandy Keola, our other gun violence prevention reporter, have been doing ahead of this election, talking to candidates about, you know, what their plans are, you know, who they're looking at in terms of other cities for examples of best practices, but then also, you know, where different activists who are working within the city and community organizations are in terms of what they're feeling and who they're voting for. And there's definitely a lot of frustration. There's definitely a lot of sort of a repeat policy from the candidates for mayor. But a lot of people are also hopeful that this will be a good turning point as well. So a little bit of everything, some mixed feelings.
Yeah. So you also covered the youth vote. Can you talk about some of the unique efforts that have been going on to get young people to the polls today?
Sure. Pennsylvania is really interesting in that it's one of the states that saw a gigantic increase in voter turnout, especially in the last couple years. But in the last 9 years, there's been a 19.5% increase in voter turnout across the state between voters 18 to 29. So that's pretty insane. Philly is unique in that, you know, voter turnout in general tends to be on the lower end. But there's a lot of groups that are out there trying to do a lot of work to you know, register voters. Drexel had a registration party where you could come and hang out and register to vote. There's been a ton of different efforts within schools. I was very lucky enough to talk to some volunteers with PA Youth Vote. These are sophomores and juniors in high school who can't vote yet themselves, but are still working on getting upperclassmen and people in their communities to register to vote as well. So there's definitely a big push for young voters, for sure.
I'm going out on a limb here, but have people speculated why there's been a big bump in youth voter turnout here in Pennsylvania specifically, or is it too early to tell why this trend has developed recently?
I think in general, nationwide, what people have been seeing is that, you know, Gen Z especially has been, you know, more in tune with social issues of all kinds. So they're definitely more connected than ever before in terms of you know, being engaged with things that they care about. Social media is a huge push. Philly has Vote Badge On and several other hashtags and social media trends trying to encourage people. But I also say that, you know, in the last few months here in Philly, at least, I've been seeing a ton of, you know, different unique ways that people are trying to reach out, like the voter registration parties I mentioned. Philly also had its first annual Civics Day at the Constitution Center last month. So there's definitely a lot of ways that young people are being connected to.
Gen Z, very active generation there. So we'll have to leave it there. Sam, good luck today as you go from poll to poll. Lots of fun. I remember those days.
I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a good day.
Thanks so much. That was Sam Searles. By the way, listeners, if you want information about this election, if you haven't cast your vote yet, we've got a hub with all sorts of great stuff. It's whyy.org/election.
And coming up on Studio 2, we're looking at cell phone etiquette and our attachment to them after two Philadelphia Orchestra concerts were interrupted by ringing phones. Call us with your questions or comment, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, you are listening to Studio 2. Last week, Cherry, we talked about the Philadelphia Orchestra's performance that was interrupted, not once, but twice, by a ringing cell phone. Here is how conductor Yannick Nézet-Séguin responded to this second interruption.
You've got to be kidding me. Can we just spend 1 hour of our life without the damn phones, please? I'm not telling you off. I'm not upset. You pay money to come here. You pay money to have a great time, not to answer the phone. Just turn it off. Everything can wait. Nothing's going to happen.
I feel like I've said that before. And well, believe it or not, though, it happened again this weekend. A ringer went off on Saturday night in Verizon Hall just as the orchestra started playing Symphonie Fantastique. This time, the maestro was a little more restrained, but clearly still frustrated.
I won't say it. The only thing I'm going to say is, now please turn your phone off completely.
What is the problem with our phones, and why are some of us so oblivious of others when we use them in a concert hall, a restaurant, or on a bus?
All right, that's the jumping off point. We're going to talk about cell phone manners and how our attachment to our phones may be harming us and our relationships with others.
Yes.
Science writer Catherine Price is here with us in the studio. She's the author of a book called How to Break Up with Your Phone, a 30-day plan to take back your life.
And you can join our conversation. Are you worried about your cell phone use? The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org. So, Catherine, we're just going to jump right in here. How do we get here? How do we get to a point where cell phones have become so pervasive a technology that the maestro of the Philadelphia Orchestra had to stop performances not once but twice to get folks to turn off their phones?
I mean, I think the question may be, how are we still at this point? Because it's been about 15 years since the first smartphones came out. So, you know, I think originally there was this element of these devices coming into our lives without any thought, and we hadn't really set the rules for etiquette, but it's been over a decade. So I have to say I am a bit shocked that it's still as much of an issue as it is in a context like the orchestra, where very clearly you should not have your phone on.
We've adopted the technology really quickly, but we have not adopted norms very quickly,
right,
or manners very quickly. I mean, help me parse that.
Well, it is one thing I always recommend that people do when they start thinking about their relationships with their phones. So when I say break up with your phones, I always like to say, I'm not saying dump your phones. I'm saying like create better boundaries and a healthier relationship. But you really want to start by just asking yourself, what is the purpose of your phone, and when is it and is it not appropriate to interact with it? So clearly, I think most people, everybody would say that in the middle of an orchestra performance, not a good time. But you do have to put in the work to then, you know, understand how to actually enforce those boundaries. I think it's actually amazing that I bet that a lot of people in the audience actually don't even know how to turn off the phone. Mm. And I'm not saying that as a criticism of them. It's actually hard. Like I've done a lot of events.
Yeah,
I mean, it's hard to turn off, you know, an iPhone 11 and up. A lot of people don't know how to do it. But we do need to put in the work to figure out what our boundaries are, what we want them to be, and then actually enforce them. But it's really unfortunate. It's still such an issue.
So I want to go back a bit to those 15 years ago. I remember my first job out of school. I did not have a device at all. And I just lived life. And then all of a sudden, we had to have Blackberries within a year. I want you to talk about the phone. What about it has sort of gotten us hooked?
Well, the entire design of the phone, and more specifically the apps on it, are they're designed to hook us. So a lot of the techniques or a lot of the features of the smartphone and the most problematic apps are deliberately copied from slot machines, which are widely considered to be the most addictive machines to ever have been invented. So things that are bright colors or the potential or guarantee in many cases of some kind of reward, those are the same things that you have in a slot machine. You lose track of time by virtue of the design of the apps, it's very similar to having how in a casino you don't have clocks or windows because you're meant to lose track of time. And why is that? It's because many of the most popular and time-sucking apps make money when we spend our time and attention on them. So there's no motivation for the app maker to not want us to not get us to spend time on them, because social media in particular makes money every time we turn our attention to it.
You have a story that is equal parts amusing and alarming about how you realized you had become so beholden to your phone. And I think it will be very relatable for a lot of people listening. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping you could just tell that story.
Sure. If it's a story I think you're talking about, I find it more alarming than I wasn't amused by my story at all. But it was about in 2016 when my daughter was a baby. Is this a story?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I was up feeding her one night, and I just had this moment of seeing this scene as if I were an outsider looking in. And there was just this, you know, scene of this mother holding a little baby, and the baby's looking up at her mother's face, and her mother's looking down at the phone. I was like, this is not how I want to be living my life.
And that started you on the path of digging into this.
Yeah, you know, I had a background in mindfulness, and I was a science reporter by training. And so I realized at that point, it wasn't that no one else was struggling with this problem. It just was that not many people were talking about it. And the people who were talking about this as an issue weren't coming up with solutions. And I didn't just want to alarm people. I was plenty alarmed myself.
Yeah.
I actually wanted to give people a plan. So that's what led me to write How to Break Up with Your Phone.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about how to break up with your phone in just a moment. But I want to talk about the chemical, what happens in your actual brain, because, you know, we're like, we don't realize that this is happening to us, but there's something that when you're on your phone that actually gets you hooked, and it's some good and some bad.
Yeah, exactly. So when I talk about the phones being designed to mimic slot machines, what I'm really saying is that they're designed to trigger the same release of chemicals in our brain that slot machines are designed to trigger. And most importantly, there's a neurochemical called dopamine, which many people associate with pleasure. But the best way to think about it is actually as a salience indicator. It's our brain's way of recording when a behavior is worth repeating. So in a natural context, you know, dopamine helps remind us to do things like eat and reproduce. So having a dopamine trigger that's, say, a raspberry bush and you're out in the woods and you're hungry, that's a great dopamine trigger because you eat the raspberry, dopamine's released. That reminds you or enforces the idea that that was a good idea to do and encourages you, motivates you to seek out the same food again in the future. That's great when it's for our survival. But our dopamine systems are totally agnostic. They do not have any judgment about whether the habit that they're about to reinforce is a good habit or a bad habit. So you can very easily manipulate people into developing, frankly, a compulsive relationship with your product simply by baking dopamine triggers into the product's design. So all of the things I was mentioning earlier, the bright colors or the potential promise of rewards or anticipation or uncertainty, those are all very powerful dopamine triggers, and they're deliberately baked into the design of some of our most time-sucking apps.
And how about the cortisol response? How does that factor in?
So the thing I just described is why I and many other experts think of smartphones as slot machines we keep in our pockets. But on the flip side, like you're saying, you also have the issue where we've been so conditioned to believe on a very biochemical level, subconscious level, that checking our phones is worth doing again and again. Then when we can't check our phones, we often feel anxious. So that's the FOMO we all feel. Whether it's FOMO about actually missing out on an experience or the anxiety-related FOMO of missing out on, like, quote, the important work email. And when you experience that anxiety, it feels uncomfortable. I think it probably does actually trigger a release of cortisol, which is one of our main stress hormones. And that feels very uncomfortable to us. So what do you do to get that stress feeling to go away? Well, you check your phone as a soothing thing. And what do you find when you check your phone? You find a dopamine trigger. And that reinforces the idea that checking your phone was worth doing. Mm. So you get into this feedback loop that keeps us stuck on our phones.
And I just think about that, and I'm just like, I was reading statistics, and we literally spend hours every day on our phone, and we check our phones hundreds of times. And I mean, is it sort of like, when do you realize? I mean, you had a moment where you're with your baby, and you realize, oh my goodness, this is horrible. But how can the average person sort of realize or come to a realization that they may be a little bit dependent on this device?
Well, I think a lot of people do recognize that if they start to think about it at all, and probably people listening, many people might be like, yeah, that describes me, but I don't know what to do about it.
Right.
That's the tricky part. But I'd also say it's really worth asking other people in your life to tell you what they think about your relationship with your phone, particularly parents, because a lot of parents will convince themselves that their kids don't really notice that they're on their phone. But there's been plenty of studies showing kids responding to their parents being on the phone. I mean, they notice immediately. And I've done work in my daughter's own school. She's now in second grade, surveying the eighth graders in that school. I actually was just looking at their responses today from a survey we did last year. They notice. They notice when their parents are on their phones, and it makes them feel really bad. So ask your loved ones how they feel about your relationship with your devices.
Let me reintroduce you. We're talking with Catherine Price, who is a science writer and the author of the book, How to Break Up with Your Phone. She also has a free phone breakup kit on her website, CatherinePrice.com. And of course, if you want to join the conversation, you can call, I guess, on your landline, 888-477-9499, or you can email us, studio2@whyy.org. I wanted to bring in an email from Bill. We were at the matinee of the ballet on Saturday, something we were just talking about, right? And halfway through the performance, someone's cell phone goes off right in front of me. Took about 30 seconds of ringing until she pulled it out of her purse. Very, very disruptive. I can't understand why people don't turn off those ringers prior to the performance. That's the email from Bill. I wanted to add to that. I wonder how often people are being sort of deliberately rude or lacking conscience, and how often people just don't even think about the fact that their phone is on because it's always on them and it's always on. It's almost like turning off your arm or turning off your knee. You know, I don't know how often it is people are being deliberately rude. I wonder if you could maybe get into that a little bit in addressing Bill's email.
I mean, I doubt anyone's trying to deliberately be rude, both because they don't want to be rude, and also it's mortifying. Can you imagine if you're that person and Yannick is like calling you out? But it does confuse me because I know at the beginning of the performances, they do ask you to silence your cell phone. So I don't know if it's just a mindlessness or inattentiveness or just thought that, you know, oh, that wouldn't be me that happens. It really does confuse me at this point. You know,
yeah, I mean, that it persists.
That it persists. I do think there's often, interestingly, a generational thing where this is very anecdotal, but older people often are the ones like my parents who I think might not know how to silence it. So then, I mean, I was at the orchestra on Saturday because a friend of mine's husband is in it. And she was like, you should give Yannick a copy of How to Break Up with Your Phone. I was like, that would be amazing to share this. So we went to drop one off and I saw the patrons in the waiting to get in. Everyone was on their phones. And obviously it's kind of an older crowd. But anyway, I don't know. I mean, hopefully incidents like this will help spread awareness. And maybe there's a new way that they should be talking to people before the performance. Again, it's crazy you have to talk to people before the performances, but whatever's happening now is clearly not working as well as it should.
Yeah, and I've been to a restaurant where, you know, you have six people at the table. No one's talking. They're all on their cell phone. So we have Jennifer from Philadelphia on the phone. She wants to talk about this whole relationship thing and cell phone use. Jennifer, you're on Studio 2. What is your question?
Hi, Jennifer. Are you with us?
Well, actually, we're going to go to Ed. Edward, you are on Studio 2. What is your question or comment?
Good morning. My wife is constantly on her cell phone. We can be watching TV, having her favorite show on. She's buried in her cell phone. She gets up in the morning. It's ready. She's got her phone going. She's reading something. At night, before she goes to bed, she's got her phone on. I'm at my wit's end because I've tried in a nice way to recommend she limit her cell phone usage, and she gets adamant about, I'm okay. Please help.
Yeah, so how do you talked about how to break up with your own cell phone, but how do you start this conversation with someone else?
Well, this is where we switch into like couples counseling. Yeah. Here. Yeah. But Ed, so I understand you're at your wit's end, but how do you actually feel when she's with you and she's doing that?
I feel ignored. I feel like it's her phone is more important to her than interacting with her husband.
Yeah. I mean, have
not
you
ever, a good feeling.
Go ahead.
I know she loves me. I mean, don't get that wrong, but she loves her cell phone, I think, almost as much.
I mean, that must be really painful.
Yeah, it's at this point, I don't know how to approach it to get her to cut back, but I really would like some suggestions as to the best way to go about it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I empathize with you, and you're certainly not alone. I mean, this is a constant thing people bring up to me whenever I speak about it. I think one of the first things to do if you haven't already is to tell her those things. I mean, she probably knows you want her to be on her phone less, but I don't know how much she understands how deeply it's actually hurting you personally and how much you feel like you've lost a part of her to it. So that would be one of my suggestions to start with.
Yeah. I wonder if there's, you know, and thank you, Edward, for that comment, because I know a lot of people feel that kind of pain. How do you sort of raise, should there be a rule at the dinner table? Should there be, because we've tried this and I'm just wondering how does that work? Should you just set up a rule when we're at dinner, no one Everybody puts their phones in the box. I mean, how should that
work? Yeah, we do have to have etiquette and guidelines. So I'd say in a personal case, you do want to actually tell the person how you truly feel. You also can ask them how they feel about your relationship with your device, which may be kind of a decoy because in many cases, the person who's hurting the most is not on their phone as much, but it's useful to kind of ask them how they feel about you. But yes, you should have a conversation about when it is and is not appropriate to have your phone out. And I would highly recommend that one of your no-phone zones, as I think of them, be the dining room table. That's not a place for phones. And I would also suggest your bedroom not be a place for phones. And you can decide what other areas in your home or what sorts of activities or experiences should be phone-free. But to me, it's very similar in concept to the quiet car on Amtrak. You know, there are signs up. It says you're supposed to be quiet. Everyone knows if you are on your phone loudly in the quiet car on Amtrak, you're breaking the rules and you're kind of being the jerk there, right? And everyone is kind of empowered to then say something to the person or give a knowing look to the conductor who can scold for you. But we do need something similar in our homes, whether it's for our partners or for our children or even in the workplace, where we actually explicitly say where phones are and are not allowed so that you can prevent arguments in the future because everyone knows what the rules are.
Let me reintroduce our guest here on Studio 2. Catherine Price is a science writer and author of the book How to Break Up with Your Phone. She also has that free phone breakup kit on her website, catherineprice.com. Catherine, so let's go through the steps of how we ditch our phones. And I know we're not ditching. We're reducing our use. But what are some of the key steps to starting this process for yourself or perhaps for someone you love who you're trying to help with that?
Yes. So a lot of times people skip to kind of quick hacks and tips and tricks, like turning your phone to grayscale, and then they inevitably turn their phone back to color and then feel like they failed. So I want to really emphasize that the first step you really need to take is to ask yourself why you'd want to cut back on phone time. You don't want this to be just an arbitrary restriction where you're like, oh, I just should. And, you know, we have so many shoulds in our lives, it's exhausting. So instead, ask yourself, well, what do you actually value in life? You know, what are your values for yourself? What are your values for your family, for your children? What do you want to be spending your time on? Because we all just have 24 hours in a day and a limited time on Earth. So what do you actually want to be spending your time and attention on? I would even go so far as to explicitly like write this down on paper, maybe even have this be a conversation between you and your loved ones. And then you can use that as a framework to evaluate how your screens are fitting into your life and whether they're supporting those goals or if they're taking away from them. I think it's very useful to have that framework in mind because it makes decision making a lot easier. You simply compare what you said you want to do against what you actually are doing. So I really suggest people start with that more philosophical step. And then you can go to steps such as the ones we were just discussing of creating physical boundaries where phones are or are not allowed, such as your bedroom or the dining room table, getting a standalone alarm clock, because if your phone's your alarm clock, which I mean, pretty much everyone's phone is their alarm clock.
Mine is for my
I know what a follow-up gift to you guys can be. Yes, because if your phone's your alarm clock, you have to touch the alarm clock to get it to be silent. So you're guaranteeing your phone's the first thing you'll interact with in the morning. And also doing things like if you know Instagram is a problem for you or TikTok or whatever, like get it off your phone. You can always reinstall it. You can always check these things from a desktop. You can experiment with different home screen layouts. But like if you were trying to quit smoking, you probably shouldn't keep a packet of cigarettes in your pocket. It would be a very bad idea. So if you've got a problem with an app, you know, don't have that be easily accessible.
But for you, you're saying it all starts with why. You got to answer the why question first. Interesting.
Yeah, and I want to remind you to join the conversation. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org. We have a comment from a listener, Damien. He says he has to be on his phone a lot for work, but he is afraid his kids will mimic his behavior. This is, you know, one of the many reasons people have. He says, how should he teach his kids to do better?
Well, I think it's a really important insight to have that your phone habits will be influential to your kids. Again, I was just looking through survey responses from eighth graders this morning, and there were a number of kids who said, I just wish my parents were more aware of what they do on their phone and that they actually did what they tell me to do. So I think, you know, there's some cases in which adults do have to be more on call than we'd like to be for work. I would argue that often it's less than we think we need to be, but sure, there are some cases. One thing would be to narrate what you're doing on your phone so you're actually telling your kid what you're doing. So it's not just this black box where for all they know, you're turning your attention away from them so that you can look at Instagram. If instead you're actually saying, I'm using this to touch base with someone. But also creating better boundaries for yourself as an adult, I think, is really important. We should take a look in the mirror and ask ourselves what our phone habits are currently, what actually is essential, how we could actually communicate with our colleagues and our employees and our bosses about what our boundaries are or the best way to communicate with us so that we actually can step away. I think one of the main reasons we all feel so burned out right now is we're never off duty. We're always on call. So even something like if you're in a workplace and you're worried about missing an emergency, if you take the time to establish and define what an emergency actually is. You know, what is an emergency? And then if that happens, how are you going to communicate it? I'd suggest that email should never be the means that you use to communicate an emergency. That should be a phone call. And if you're able to actually systematize that in the workplace, then you actually empower your employees and colleagues to step away from their phones during work, you know, off time, because they're confident that they don't have to, they're not going to find out about, they're not going to miss an emergency. And that time away is so essential for us to actually enjoy our lives, but also to rejuvenate, nourish ourselves, and avoid burnout.
Catherine, we all remember being told as kids, television's going to rot your brain. I saw an interview where you mentioned that there was a Victorian era panic about kaleidoscopes.
True story.
So convince me that this is not a moral panic and that our relationship with cell phones is really, truly different qualitatively than our relationship with other technologies that have come along.
Yes, it is. And I mean, that's a common question people have. What makes these things different? I think the most succinct explanation I've seen comes from Tristan Harris, who originally was a product philosopher at Google, and then he left and became the founder of the Center for Humane Technology. And he talks about how with your traditional landline telephone or your television, you didn't have thousands of engineers on the other side of that device deliberately trying to steal your attention from you. They weren't interactive in two-way. You know, a traditional television wasn't able to ping you with a notification. You also didn't carry it in your pocket. So you weren't just pulling out like a giant desktop computer on the elevator or your television and watching 30 seconds of a movie and sticking it back in your pocket.
It's ubiquitous in a different way.
Yeah. It's two things. It's that they're so portable, but more importantly, they're interactive and there's a two-way relationship where there's people and companies whose incentive it is to steal your attention from you who are experts in what they call brain hacking, such as the dopamine tricks we were talking about earlier. And they are... they're very smart and very good at what they do, and they have access to us and our kids at all times through our devices. That was not the case with a landline telephone, with our traditional television, and certainly not with a kaleidoscope.
Definitely not with a kaleidoscope.
And I want to talk etiquette a little bit and wrap in this email from Mary. She says, how about those using their phones in dark movie theaters to read messages and emails? I too, Mary, hate that. And she says, the light is disturbing. So let's talk etiquette. The places where you say no cell phones, and then other times where, you know, cell phones are okay.
Well, my personal view, yeah, as we were talking about bedrooms, including your kids' bedrooms, I mean, in part because you don't know what they're looking at or doing on their phones in their bedrooms, but everyone's bedrooms, dining room tables, I think meetings are much more productive if you just have one person taking notes, but everyone else has devices away. Certainly public performances, concerts. I mean, I think one thing that people in the audience don't recognize is that the performers can actually see those lights and that it's extremely distracting and, you know, not very respectful for them to look out in the middle of their performance and see all these blue lights on people's faces. That's horrible. So I'd say that. I'd also say mealtimes in public where you're paying money and making the time to go see your friends. I mean, guys, we're coming out of the pandemic where we couldn't be with people in person. And now we go to dinner and we've got one eye trained on the phone, or you see entire tables of people out at often fancy restaurants where they're just on their phones. To me, that's really horrifying. So I would say that. I see a lot of cases where people have their babies or kids in strollers and the kids are on phones. I would encourage people. I mean, I do not like to be judgy. I'm a fellow parent. I know how hard it is.
Right.
But ask yourself why you are giving your kid a screen. The American Academy of Pediatrics does not think kids under two should be on screens basically at all. And then 2 to 5, it's basically if they're like FaceTiming with a grandparent. But in many cases, we're using the screens as drugs for kids as a way to soothe them. And so that it reminds me actually of an example from the era of patent medicines where there are these soothing syrups that people give colicky babies, and those syrups really worked. And the reason they worked is they had morphine in them.
Yeah. Wow.
Right? It's a drug. So I say that not to pass judgment, but just to encourage us all to ask ourselves, what's the purpose of the screener device in this moment, and does it align with our values?
Well, we have to wrap it up. At some point, maybe we'll bring you back. I want to talk about what these companies can do, because we've talked a lot about helping ourselves. But these companies, as you mentioned, have made these products addictive by design. And perhaps there's another conversation we had another day about that. We can't have it today. I'm so
bummed. A lot of money off of us.
So much money.
So much money. That's Catherine Price, by the way, science writer, author of the book, How to Break Up with Your Phone. Catherine, thank you so much for being here on Studio 2 and helping us out.
Thanks so much for having me.
So coming up next on Studio 2, Tanya Mosley, the new co-host of Fresh Air, will be with us in Studio 2. Looking forward to that.
Stick with us.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Aaron.
In 1975, WHYY's Terry Gross took to the microphone to host Fresh Air. Since then, she has interviewed nearly every major history maker, politician, artist, actor, and performer of a generation, and has created an archive that is unparalleled. Terry and her team have taken home a number of awards, including most recently the Peabody Institutional Award just last year.
We're very proud of the show, of course, and our colleagues that work on it. And now we are proud to say there's a fresh voice coming to NPR's Fresh Air. I'm the first one to ever make that pun, right? The show has a new co-host, and we are very happy to welcome Emmy Award-winning journalist Tanya Mosley here in the studio today. Hello, Tanya.
Hi, Avi. Hi, Cherry. Thank you for having me. You'll be happy I came in without my cell phone. I heard the last segment. Like, I'm making progress. This is good.
I'm not going to admit that it's in my pocket right now.
Yeah, mine is sitting right here, but, you know, we digress. Well, first of all, congratulations on being named co-host.
Thank you.
I'm a true fan of yours and have heard your voice on Fresh Air for quite a while. Now that it's official, I had to ask you, what about Fresh Air attracted you to the role in the first place?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, I've been a journalist. I'm going to date myself, I guess. But I've been a journalist for about 25 years now. And it has always been a dream. I think it's all of our dreams to be able to sit down and have a deep and narrow conversation. So much of the work we do is wide and thin. We try to get deep in those moments. But I was a television reporter for quite a bit of time. And you and I were talking right before the break, Cherry. Mm-hmm. Like a minute 30 was wonderful. If you've got 2 minutes, I mean, that's like a documentary, right? So I'm excited that I am in this position to be able to have those deeper conversations with important people that help us learn more about the world and ourselves and each other.
Yeah. You mentioned you come from a commercial television background before public radio. You worked in Fort Wayne, right, Indiana?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, you've done your history.
Louisville, Kentucky.
That's right.
You worked in Seattle as well. I'm curious, was there something that you felt or you feel that commercial television does better than public radio? Because we can be very cloistered here in public radio sometimes.
Yeah.
Anything that you take over from that you think, I would love to bring that over into the public radio space?
Well, you know, there was one thing. The moment I got into radio, I thought, nobody leaves the building. No one leaves the studio. You know, when you're a television reporter, you're going to a new location every single day. You're in people's homes. You're in lots of different places and offices and things like that. And that really gave me a sense of the world that I think has been really helpful at this second stage in my career. Yeah, you're just not afraid to talk to anybody because you're kind of forced to talk to folks. You know, you can't come back to the newsroom with nothing. So
that right there. And I too come from commercial radio and TV. And I got to ask you, what opportunities did you see in public media generally? And then what was the biggest challenge you think you've overcome to find national success here at this point?
Yeah. I'm still, you just said that and I'm like, wow, that is, I am sitting in the WHYY studio. You know, even when I was a television reporter, the photographers that I used to work with, I used to have a few of them, they would call me the public radio of television, in part because when we'd be out in the field in the car, I'd always have on NPR and I'd love to talk about the stories and kind of infuse a little bit of what I heard on the radio with reporters, that sonic quality of being able to be immersive, you know, even though it's visual, the sonic part of it is so important in the experience. And so I was always trying to bring that to my work. And so I mean, being able to be an audio journalist was a dream come true, because there's also an intimacy there. When the camera is away, they're able to connect with you. They're not blinded by the cameras and the lights. That was a huge plus, but it was also a learning curve for me the first few years, because I had learned to be very efficient in television, and it allowed me to slow down and take heed and take note of the other types of details that maybe I didn't notice as a television reporter, because you're so focused on the visual.
So you mentioned that you were drawn in part to this job because you get to go deep
and narrow.
Yeah. But did you ever have a moment of, as you started getting more involved with Fresh Air, like doubt, like, is this the direction I definitely want to go? I mean, this is, you know, you're stepping into this enterprise, has huge exposure. There's going to be more scrutiny, I would imagine. Did you ever have any doubt? Maybe the answer is no, but if you did, I'm curious how you worked through that, because you really are, you know, you're taking on this huge role in the public media landscape.
Man, Avi, I didn't think about that until, like, I had accepted the job. And
really?
I was talking with a friend, and she was like, oh, people are going to know your name now.
Yep.
And I said, oh, my gosh, you're right. I mean, all the Twitter trolls that I see, like, you know, messing with my other more well-known friends, they're going to be coming for me now. You know,
yeah.
I'd had a little bit of that. You know, my journalism did elicit a little bit of that. But I guess I don't have any. You asked me, did I have any reservations? And I would say no, because I do believe that my career has led me up to this point. I kind of, you know, 25 years, I'm ready to take on any of those things that come my way. And no, I didn't have any reservations about the idea. It's a dream job to be able to sit in a seat and have conversations with people who are open and ready to have those types of conversations with you.
And speaking of conversations, I want to talk identity a bit.
Yeah.
You grew up in Detroit, very black city. Mm-hmm. You know, you've been a black woman in white spaces for most of your career. You tell all stories well, regardless of who the subject is, but you're not afraid to lean all the way in and talk about race, gender, really tough, sticky subjects. I want to talk about how do you view your role? Like, do you feel led? Do you feel obligated to do this good work? Like, how do you feel as far as, like, your position, as far as your motivation in doing the work? Is it in line with your identity?
I love this question, because starting in television, it's a very visual medium, of course. And it was pretty obvious very early on, I was not white. I was not a blonde-haired woman. I was not a skinny woman. And so I was already othered in that space anyway. I was never going to be it. It didn't matter what I would do. I was not going to be that. Mm. And so really, it became really clear early on to me, well, I just have to be me. I have to lean into the stories that are important, that I know need to be out there for the audiences that are listening that are not white, because they're listening just as much or watching just as much as everyone else. And so that is my role in this space. No one else is going to do it here, but it's really important. And so from the beginning of my career, I love exploring all topics. I've been an education reporter, a crime and courts reporter. I have been, politics reporter. And so in all of those spaces, I've just found ways to be able to also amplify issues and topics and socioeconomic issues that I think are important to talk about.
And you were able to find that yourself, like you were able to realize that. That's an amazing amount of self-awareness, it seems, for a young reporter to seize that early on. It sounds like early on in your career.
Yeah, and maybe it's because I love this work so much. I knew from the time I was a young girl that I wanted to do it. And so, you know, I knew I wasn't going to quit the profession, but I didn't want to be miserable in it.
Interesting. Wow. So you've been listening to a voice that you know very, very well. That is Tanya Mosley, the new co-host of fresh air. Tanya, thank you so much for being with us on Studio 2. We're just thrilled to have you.
Oh, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you.
I look forward to hearing you on Fresh Air. And that is it for us. For more of Studio 2, head to WHYY.org/Studio 2. You can follow WHYY on Twitter. We use the hashtag Studio 2.
Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our engineer is Diana Martinez from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us today.
See you tomorrow.